Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is April 20th, 2022, and I am here in Fairbanks, Alaska with Al Ketzler Jr., who goes by the nickname of Bear. Is that
That's correct.
Correct?
Yeah.
At his home.
All my life. Yeah.
Well, so thank you for letting me come visit you today at your house. And so really what this is going to be about is about ANCSA. We will pause for a second.
Okay,
so this interview is focused on the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act and land claims period and before the act. So it's for the ANCSA Project Jukebox. But leading up to that, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and your personal history so people know who they're listening to.
Okay. Well, I'm, you know, of course, raised in Nenana. And you know, my raising the animal goes from the middle, or the early, late 50s, you know, all the way until I left in, to the Marine Corps in 1975. And so, you know, over those courses of the period of that time, it's was very apparent my parents were involved in something that, you know, especially in my dad, since he was traveling all the time.
And we say who your parents
and my parents was Delois Ketzler and Al Ketzler Sr. And you know, lucky for us, I guess, at least my mother was kept us very much informed of what, you know, what your dad, our dad, was doing. And you know, for some, you know, I for optimism or whatever, but they felt that they were on the right track. And that, you know, by the way, we're going to get, you know, basically our land back, you might say, some sort of a aspect of some sort of a settlement. And so, you know, that's.
So your parents were very involved in the early land claims. I know the story.
Right.
But
yeah,
and somebody they were, listening wouldn't know it.
Yeah. And well, they my mother's dad, Charlie Purvis, he was an activist all the time, and he was kind of an activist that to help the underdog, I think, was his. You know, he's a Kansas City boy and got sent off when he was very young to World War II, and which changed his life quite a bit, in a sense of what he's seen. He did most of his tour in the Philippines, and the way, you know, that way that people were treated in the Philippines. But he came to Alaska and came to Nenana, and he, you know, came up to Alaska to kind of, you know, look for, seek employment opportunities, because at that time there was quite a bit of activity here in Alaska in relation to building military infrastructure. And so he made it up here, and when he got to, you know, my hometown where I was raised, Nenana, in the early 50s, the people that befriended him were the local Native people there. And Chief Frank Alexander, who was an elderly man then, when my grandpa met him, he had to be in his, he was already in his 70s, because he lived to be close to 100.
Wow.
Because on the basketball team, when I was a freshman, we were all the pallbearers for him, because he was very much an avid basketball fan. And even though he acknowledged to my mother, he said that, you know, I don't know what they're doing out there, but it's good to see the young men out there doing and being busy, you know.
That's good.
Doing something.
Yeah. Keeping you out of trouble, right?
Keeping out of trouble. But, so, yeah, my grandfather, came and trusted with the Native community, and that led to meeting other people. And at that time, the state of Alaska, well, Alaska hadn't been created yet, but there was a talk that Alaska will, you know, become a state of the union. And it was a concern of the native people, like, you know, if the state comes, you know, what do we have? I mean, what about our trap lines? What about our fishing rights? You know, what about subsistence? And already the laws, you know, the white man laws were well in place, because there was a lot of people from Nenana that would end up in the state, or the it wasn't called the state then because we weren't a state, but the federal marshal system, you know, for hunting, killing a moose out of season, killing ducks, you know. And so that was, you know, very apparent that that was already happening. And so, and if there was a moose killed, it was, it's just like anywhere, they had a list of suspects, and the marshals would come in and say, okay, Charlie Smith, you did it, you're going to jail.
Wow.
You know, that's how, you know, kind of. And so my grandfather, not only and or being approached that way from the Native community, when he's seen the injustice, you know, that they was hard to get jobs. I mean, they couldn't get jobs, you know, working for the, especially for the military, industrial, be it private contractors or for the military themselves and building infrastructure. You know, so the only jobs that were kind of available for the Native community was the railroad, the hardworking, the linemen, you know, the ones that pounded the spike and lay track. And then another area that the Native community did get jobs was were on the boats in the summer. Those were run by the federal government. The steamer, right. Alice, and the steamer Nenana and all of them, they got deckhand jobs, or what they call firemen. And of course, you know, the firemen were the guys that ran the boilers 6 hours on, 6 hours off. And that was a job that nobody else wanted to do, stand in front of the hot boilers and load it up with firewood all day and on 6 hour shifts. So anyway, that's another aspect that, you know, my grandfather, you know, witnessed when he got to the Nenana area. Of course, he met Minto people, because Minto people are related to Nenana people, and then Nenana people are related to the Wood River people, which there wasn't that many people left in Wood River at that time, but that's where Chief Thomas was kind of originally from. And there was, you know, there's four tribes that kind of lived in the Nenana area.
So the other ones were Tolovana?
The Tolovana, the Nenana, you know, the Fishtail, the Beavertail tribe, the Middle tribe. Yeah, there's a tribe called the Middle tribe. That's kind of where some of the Elizabeth Sonnybo, or Elizabeth Domenoff's family's from, was from the Middle tribe. That's where Mitch Domenoff.
Oh, okay.
It was him. He's a Middle tribe member. And
the Kantishna?
Yeah, that's
that,
that's kind of the Middle tribe. Yeah.
Minchumina, not Kantishna. That's sort kind of the Middle tribe.
Yeah, that's kind of that kind of related there. The Dykes, and the last name Dyke, Percy Dyke and Greta. And so, yeah, there was that group there. And because I was, you know, later on in life, I was, you know, I guess really kind of lucky enough that a friend of mine, Bill Stroker, who was at that time, when I met him, he was already retired as a banker, but he was still had an office in a bank. And I bought a piece of property from him. And he found that I was a history, you know, interested in history, and especially, and of course, in the Native community. And he had a lot of history of the Native community. He was very much interested in that. And he had friends all over, from Eagle to Fort Yukon. He had all these different friends. Artisans. He bought a lot of Native art, you know. And I just learned recently here at his estate sale that how much Native art he had purchased over the years. He had quite a bit. But he found he told me that he had found, read years ago, the captain's log, or the captain's journal of the first trip up the Tanana River in the summer of 1898, which is many years before the first person that they give credit to, Adams, bringing.
Oh, it was before Adams.
Oh, yeah, way before, yeah. Adams didn't come up till 1902 or 1903, somewhere near. Yeah, when he landed and that's where he landed, right, as far as he could go, is where Fairbanks,
right,
you know, was developed. But so anyway, and the Captain Morgan's recount, you know, he had a lot of history of the Native people in there himself.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, getting that, about 28 pages that was written in the late 20s or early 30s. So it was like 30 years later,
right,
he wrote this for the Nome Nugget.
Oh, okay.
The newspaper.
Right.
And kind of turned it into, so that's how I got my hands on a copy of that.
But mm-hmm. So, can I ask what year mm-hmm. you were born?
I was born in 56.
Okay, and where mm-hmm. do you fall? Aren't there five or six of you?
I'm the oldest of six.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, what are your sort of earliest memories of what was happening in the house with your parents and your grandfather and what was going on?
Right, right. Well, I mean, I you know, because in those days, you didn't have babysitters or childcare or nothing. So, you know, my mother would, you know, load us up, be it on the wagon or on a little dog sled or something, and haul us around to these meetings. And so I, you know, remember some of the meetings, probably starting in the early 60s. I know they had meetings before then. I mean, things were well underway and to a certain degree, but so, you know, it seemed pretty consistent that there are always meetings at our house. Mm-hmm. Not only meetings around my dad's work, the summer work, which is on the docks, you know, there was a organization of the union there, right. So there are a lot of meetings there, but then my grandfather would bring people in, you know, and he had developed a connection to, well, I would call the intellectual class of Fairbanks, you know, Sandy Jensen, you know, a university person, but he had connected to the university. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how, might have been through the Unitarian Church or Quakers Church or something. But
was he involved with
I mean, he would go to different churches, denominations, and just get to know the people. He would, you know, he just loved learning about different people, be it Jewish or, you know, black. So anyway, that, you know, he would introduce some of these people, and they would come down, and he would, by the time they came to Nenana, they were already committed, like, oh, this is exciting, you know, this is exciting stuff, working to, you know, for, on behalf of the Native people, you know. And then at that time, it was Native people, it wasn't presented as statewide, my mind wasn't around a statewide thing, but it was about indigenous claims to the land. So, and I have been fortunate enough, you know, in the early 60s, when Alfred Starr, who is primarily the person who fed my grandfather information, you know, about this indigenous claims, mm-hmm. you know. And so Alfred, at the meetings, you know, during potlatches in Indiana, which in those days there was a potlatch, you know, we didn't have potlatches just for deaths like we have today. Mm-hmm. It used to be a potlatch for anything, really. Okay. I mean, it's just, you know, the spring fish catch to, you know, to a turkey shoot. I mean, there were always gatherings, you know, people coming together. And so whenever there was a group of more than probably 10 or 12 people, Alfred would be the first one, and eventually became elected chief. But he would always bring up that, you know, this is our land, and, you know, we got to secure our future. We got to secure our people. We got to educate our kids, and, you know, all that aspects.
And so that the people from Fairbanks, who your grandfather kind of mm-hmm. got excited about it, and they came to Nenana again, mm-hmm. it was a more localized effort. They weren't out there looking for land claims statewide yet. It was
Right. That wasn't, you know, until, you know, until, you know, my mother started getting really involved, and she's the one that kind of, you know, wanted to bring it into a more broader aspect, you know. So she had, you know, she had written letters to, you know, the most community or person in Alaska that everybody kind of knew that he was championing Native land claims movement was a Southeastern Indian, a Tlingit. And
William Paul?
William Paul, okay. Yeah. So, and then Charlie and him, they communicated by mail, and my mother. And so they got a feel of what his, you know, his position was, as well as Lord. Normally his position was the position of the Tlingit and Haida clan. And but, you know, there again, it was like, for William Paul, I'm sure was like, oh, right, there's another group out there, you know, that's also looking at this. You know, it wasn't until, you know, a number of years later where they kind of broke away from his philosophy of how things should be settled. He wanted to go to the court. He wanted to take it to court. I don't know if he wanted to take it to international court, but he had a legal background, though.
Right.
He was, I believe he was an attorney, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he was.
Yep, and he wanted, he felt that that was the way to do it. Let's set up a, but.
Well, it.
But the, Charlie Purvis told him, you know, I remember that very clear, is that the courts cannot compensate with land. And the Native people, they want the land. We don't care about the money. William was all about the money. Let's give them a big settlement. And so that's where they eventually parted, kind of parted ways in a sense of what the interior was going to do, because, like I said, my mother was kind of the one that organized the first Tano Chief meeting in Nenana.
Okay.
Yeah, that was in like March or April during the dog mushing times.
Right, of 61 or 62?
62. Yeah. And so that's, in fact, Robert Charlie was there at that first meeting. Yeah, he just happened to be in town from Minto.
Oh,
and they said he heard about this meeting. Yeah, no, he was passing. I think he was coming from Fairbanks. They had dog team trail. There was a highway all over the place and well traveled. And so yeah, he stopped with somebody. I forgot who was with him. And they stopped in the end, and because I remember him commenting to me that was one of the best meetings that he ever been to, in a sense of it getting him involved, because he was able to go back to Minto and say, God, there's a man and this wonderful meeting in Anna, and we're, you know, and at that time they were living in Minto where we know it today.
Right.
They were living on
the
Tano River.
The old Minto.
Yeah, so, the old Minto. Yeah.
And what we now call old Minto.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was, so that was before the big Denahanesh.
That was just before that. Yeah.
So that,
cause that was at that meeting when it was decided. I'm not sure who brought it up, but probably somebody like Robert Charlie or somebody that was an elderly officer. Because somebody, I believe that somebody was there, said, you know, the traditional way of the interior natives in establishing boundaries and hunting and marriage and trading goods was done at the Nuchlioaya. And so that's, in, you know, I remember my mother saying, well, what's the Nuchlioaya? And they, you know, so they described what it was. And it was also athletics. It was kind of like the you know, for the Greeks, you know, the Olympics.
Was it, so it was like a trading festival?
It was a trading, you know, and the chiefs would marry off their daughters and they'd marry off their sons. I mean, it was a lot of, over the years. And apparently, the last Nuchlioaya, I think, was in like 1916, 1918, somewhere in there, pretty early. And so that's when it was like, wow, that's what we need to bring back, the Nuchlioaya. We need to bring that back. And we need to hold it in its traditional grounds. And because Tanana was the most, you know, geographically the most logical place. I mean, it's just down
where the rivers meet.
Where the rivers meet, and you know, so you know, pretty much any village could attend, and which you know, and today in our what we've learned, you know, going upstream, you know, with a canoe or even a big a log raft, that was commonly done. You know, I mean, I have stories from Alfred Starr that he, you know, ran a raft from down way down river from the boneyard up to Tanana.
Wow.
You know, and they used dogs.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they used dogs in the bank, and they just raft up the whole family, all their goods and everything, right up the river.
Which is amazing, because it's not like the bank is even, you know.
Right.
It goes up and
down. Well, over the years, they cleared it. I mean,
it
was
a part of a trail.
Like a trail, yeah. Well, they did all that stuff. Yeah, it was.
That's not easy, though.
It was not easy, but they made, you know, good time, and, you know, it was just a method, a way of traveling. Of course, downstream was you load the dogs on the raft with you, and you...
Right.
And you moved right along.
But by 1962, when this meeting was going on, people had small outboard motors for the most part.
Yeah,
by that point.
Outboard motors. Yeah, and there were a lot of boats that came to that meeting. Now the whole Tanana was probably had never seen so many boats. You know, since the canoes were there, you know, 40, 50 years earlier for the Nuchiwaya, because well, they're still today. They have athletic activities where canoe racing.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a long distance run. Let's see what other. They had something like a rope pull like aspect too. I remember them, but yeah, they had all kinds of different athletic activities, but yes, they had, you know, by 62 they had Little Johnson and Scotty Motors that they came in on.
That helped.
Yeah.
So when that meeting happened,
In Tanana. Yeah.
You were 6?
I was 6 years old, yeah. I just turned 6. I turned 6 in May.
So you have memories of it?
Oh, yeah, very, very clear, yeah. Because there were so many characters that were there that you couldn't forget. You know, and I remember Ruth Charles really well. She's one of the most, you know, persons I remember the most, and it was just because she was a wonderful cook. And not only that, being an outspoken lady, and she was a delegate from Dot Lake. You know, that she was a white lady.
Oh, she was.
She was a white lady, a full-blooded white. Not sure where she's. I think she was originally from Washington State, Seattle area or something. She married her husband Charles, Carl Charles. Yeah, they had one. Well, they had a couple kids. They adopted two, but Ted Charles is their son. If you ever met Ted,
no.
Yeah, he's a little older than I am, but anyway, Chief Andrew Isaac. When he, you know, learned of this aspect, he wanted somebody who could communicate by, you know, she's a really good typist as well.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she was like my mother was the thing.
Right.
She had a little bit of skills of, you know, at least knowing how to operate a typewriter, which were very rare to have, but if you had a typewriter. I mean, there was one in Indiana that went from house to house to house to house, you know. Yeah, it's like a sewing machine.
Right.
Went everywhere. But Chief wanted her to be, as well as she was already pretty outspoken already herself. She had, if you look at the Tanana Chief's minutes of that first meeting in 62, even though they don't have their names, but listening to her all over the years, I know exactly where this resolution came from, which, you know, she was always really hell-bent on native hire. They were building that road through Toke, you know, and keeping it upgraded in Tanana. And I remember her saying there were no native people hired. We need to hire more native. And from that influence, from that chief meeting, they were state of Alaska. We were state by then.
Right.
We're hired Native people, and they retired from DOT.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Another was schools, village schools. She was very much an advocate of village schools. In fact, I wrote a letter years later to the superintendent of the school district in Tok, and said that the Dalt Lake School should be in her name. I don't know that. I don't think they have yet, but it should be the root, because without her, clearly, without her influence, that school wouldn't have been there.
Mm-hmm.
The Northway School wouldn't have been there.
Right.
The Tok School is already there.
Right. Tetlin has a school.
And the Tetlin has a school. But pretty much all the schools, the new schools that were built in the middle 70s to the 80s, were primary from her influence of putting rural schools, into all communities, no matter how big or small.
Right.
But, so I could, and got to know her enough, I could read the resolutions, the ones that she had introduced and championed.
Who else do you remember from that meeting?
Oh, okay. Let's see. Matthew Titus, Chief Matthew Titus from Minto. And, they called him, his nickname in the Native community was translated to bear killer.
Hmm.
So, of course, when somebody like that, they would whisper to me, "Oh, that's bear killer," So, of course, you want to know, why is that,
Right.
But he was not a big guy or nothing, just stout and everything, but he had told me once, many years later after I first met him, that he figured he killed like 80 bears.
Wow.
With a spear.
Yeah.
A hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, he was good.
Yeah, he was truly, he earned his nickname. And so everybody kind of beware of him, because if he can take on a bear, he'll take on anybody.
Yeah.
And which that was his persona.
And was he like that?
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He would tell me, "Bear, if you don't do this, I'm going to kick your butt." And he would say, I may be an old man, but I can kick your butt. You know that, right? He would jump out of the couch like he's ready to go. he was a character. But he meant it, though. He wanted his young to do things, to be, a positive influence in his community. So to, a lot of us younger people, he would talk that way. And, let's see. Yeah, I remember, of course, I remember Robert Charlie being there, There's a Bill Fredson. He was from Metlakatla area. There was a whole group of us that flew on one particular flight out of Fairbanks. And so there's an airplane shot of us on a wing airplane.
Right.
And I'm standing there. And so I remember standing there and getting the picture taken, because my mother said, "Hey, we need to turn around here." And Ted Hetzel, was there. And I'm pretty sure he took that shot. In fact, I almost know he is, because there was no real nice professional shot of the whole airplane and all the passengers getting ready to get on. Those planes then were 28 seats or something. So there was probably close to 28 of us sitting out there standing to get on the airplane. And that was the leaving, Tannen, after being there for 3 or 4 days. And then the nightly events, they would have traditional potlatch and dancing, and they would lay out, in the old days, they would lay out skins, blankets all on the ground. You never walked on the ground, so it was, you didn't get the food dirty or nothing,
right.
So it was, it was probably one of the last kind of traditional times maybe of a true super gathering of Native people, but they did it the best they could as far as the memory wise of a real, potlatch. And I remember the Episcopal priest and his wife that were there in Tannen. If I remember correctly, they burned up in a fire soon after that next winter or something like that.
So they were the priest in Tannen.
Yeah, they hosted us. That's where I stayed at the place that burned up.
Wow.
Yeah, I've seen their grave. I've been to the graveyard in Tanawha, and they're buried in the native graveyard.
Oh, that's nice.
And yeah, that was a tragedy, definitely. And let's see. Well,
there's that one photograph of your dad up at a table up in front with Wilma Ketzler.
Clarabelle, probably.
It's Clarabelle.
Yeah.
It's mislabeled as Wilma. It's Clarabelle.
Yeah, it's Clarabelle. Yeah. And Clarabelle Charlie, yeah.
Okay.
She was a secretary, yeah.
And she was from Minto then?
No, I thought she was raised in Indiana. She might have been born in Minto, I was thinking about it.
Well, maybe Charlie was maybe married name.
But no. She's Clarabelle. That's Eli and Eli's daughter.
Okay.
Eli and Winnie. Winnie was her mother.
Okay.
She's one of the older girls, yeah.
Okay.
She's still alive, actually. I think she lives in Las Vegas.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, she's, probably in her just a few years younger than my mother, so she'd be getting close to 80. My mother's 80, going to be 85 this year, I think, 86.
Okay. So that was Clarabelle. She was the secretary.
Yeah.
But the name Wilma Ketzler, she's... Mm-hmm. Was married to one of your uncles?
Yeah, to my cousin.
Oh, to
Charlie,
your cousin.
To Charlie Ketzler, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in the meeting-wise, as far as I did go to some of the meetings, not all of them.
I was going
to
ask if you did, yeah.
Because I would just sit back with my grandfather in the back, and then when they'd ask for white people to leave, I remember some of them saying, oh, Charlie, you could stay. But no, Charlie's, no, I'm gonna leave because... I want you guys, He didn't want to let the other white people that were leaving felt that they had, there was going to be any special white people staying in the meeting or whatever. But because that's when I first, remember, and I'm sure I met him, the lead doctor for the hospital there.
Hmm.
His name was Dr. James.
Hmm.
Yeah, and his, I don't know if they were married yet then. Let's see. Yeah, she was from Fort Yukon, a real, real beautiful
lady. Is that Bill
lady.
James?
Dr. James, yeah.
He
retired from Tanawha Chiefs as their lead doctor.
Okay, I know who he is.
Yeah.
Or was.
Yeah. So he was got stationed in Tanawha under, I think it was called PHS, and Public Health Service.
Yep.
And so
it was a big hospital there.
It was a very big hospital,
But so why were the white people asked to leave?
When they were talking about delicate issues and stuff, they felt... the delegate from Dot Lake, I said she didn't have to leave, but all the non-delegates and non-whites or the non-natives had to leave. When they decided to talk about the land and what they were, they didn't really want, because it was a big mystery, even in the papers, if you go back and look under Seaton, he was a newspaper guy here on the newspaper. We have I don't know where it is now, but I read a letter he wrote to the district attorney then, who was Ted Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, he didn't use the word F, but he said, who in the hell is this guy, Al Ketzler Sr.? And he's riling up these Indians, and I'm really afraid that these Indians getting too far on. Nothing specific in the letter, but that looking back on it, the non-native community, didn't really know quite what the whole aspect was about because it was still being developed.
Right.
The whole concept. Okay. Yeah. Alfred, Starr said this is our land. Okay. Charlie Burbage believes it. That was even after that state judge came down to Nenana.
Mary S. Miller.
And heard the tribe of Nenana present their case. Is this something that can hold up in a court of law? And she said, yes, it can. And that was because I remember them leaving the meeting just jubilated. My mother was just wow, this is so neat. It was kind of like a validation that, we're really on the right track.
Yeah.
And so, so anyway, and of course, getting all the tribes together, it was a lot more complicated than what I think the original delegates in the meeting in Enana or the little forming group in Enana right. had thought, because there was a whole lot more issues that they'd ever imagined.
Right. It wasn't just, it turned out yeah. not to be just land.
It wasn't just land. It was the Rampart Dam. It was the education, the jobs, the training, you know, just all aspects of transportation, you know, the mail. I mean, there is just the whole aspects that's, you know.
Yeah, and so this meeting was organized within the Native community. Did the non-Natives know that it was going to happen? And
yeah, they had heard about it because they seen the flyers that went to the, you know, they somehow somebody would get information over.
And to the newspaper.
To the newspaper, you know. And so, yeah, this meeting in Tanana. And of course, that was a kind of a political year, because I remember Grant Pearson was mm-hmm. in the House of Representatives representing Tanana and Enana in that area. Grant was from Enana. That's when I first met him.
Is that the Grant Pearson who was at Denali? It's a different Grant Pearson.
Mm-hmm. And see, he was, I got pictures of him. He was a short, heavy set guy. You know, somebody that I would say that Jack Ogill probably got into politics. Mm-hmm. You know, Jack was kind of the in the non-Native community, the kingmaker.
Right.
You know.
In Enana.
Yeah, in Enana. Yeah. He got Swanson. What was his name? Red Swanson. He got him. He got Ogill arranged for him to get the Native votes to win. And, you know, and yeah. Jack was surprisingly, because my grandfather is the one that started the Republican Party in Enana. The first one, you know. And Jack, I don't know if they, you know, in those days there wasn't the emphasis, you know, on parties.
Right.
You know, the Democrat Republican hadn't hit to Alaska yet because right. it hadn't been a state. And but, you know, Charlie, he called himself a Lincoln Republican, and which meant to him some very, very fundamental principles. You know, I don't know what he would think now, knowing more about
right.
his you know, some of the things that he did that we know now that wasn't known back, you know,
right.
50 years ago.
Well, and the Republican Party has changed. Well, all the politics
yeah,
has changed.
Yeah, has changed. Yeah. And so, yeah, and Charlie started Republican Party because he got my dad involved in Republican Party, and my dad actually ran against, I think probably against Grant Pearson, probably, who was on the Democratic side. And, I think my point was, Ogill was kind of, became real involved in the Republican Party. And
well, he would have certainly heard about the meeting being planned because it was in Enana.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And at that time, in that meeting in Tanana, it was like Grant Pearson, he wanted to be there, and they invited BIA officials that from the Fairbanks office, which I knew them. I knew them, had met some of them before they went to Tanana, because we'd go to the courthouse. Let's see, their office used to be over in the bowling alley. You know that BIA
in what is now the bowling
yeah,
alley
downstairs of that Chinese restaurant.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I
knew that building used to be the.
Yeah, there was all government offices down there.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just remember that myself because that's. I was thinking, well, where's the BIA? Because there was a Pete Six Gun Killer. He was an Indian from a Sioux Indian.
Hmm.
He played. He was a very famous basketball player for the Air Force.
Oh.
Yeah, he got to travel a lot. And then he was a big, big Indian, but he was also very heavy set. And you give him a basketball, and my God, that guy could move. You'd never seen something so big. But he was, you know, that's my first impressions of him. He was one heck of a basketball player. And all those, you know, not, but some of those bureaucrats, you know, the federal
right.
government made it there, as well as there was even a presentation of the Rampart Dam that came there too.
Wow. And what was the response to that?
They wanted to sell the concept. And it was, It wasn't, I remember really well in a sense that I wish I could recite it. It is, I'm sure it's recited somewhere, but after they made the presentation and they were asked to field in, fielding questions in the crowd, and the chief of Tannenhall, see, the chief was Arlie Charlie, but Alfred Grant, I'm not sure what capacity Alfred Grant was there. He might have been second chief or something, or he might have been first chief, and Arlie wasn't the chief yet then. But anyway, Alfred asked the question, okay, if I got this right, do you want to build this big dam? And about 4 or 5 years later, the water's going to make its way up, and it's going to flood Beaver, and it's going to flood Stevens Village, and it's going to flood, there was another community up on the river.
Birch.
Dead Man. It's not there anymore.
Okay.
Then it's going to make its way to Fort Yukon and flood Fort Yukon. So they had just made a commitment an hour or two before that on another discussion about building. There was a discussion about schools. And so the BIA official and Grant were saying, oh, yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Percy Herbert was the person from Fort Yukon. Mm-hmm. He said, well, our schools in Tannenhall, you know, we can't even hardly keep the fire going enough, hot enough to keep the school warm. And the kids have to dress, and it's an old building that the military had left. It was a real dilapidated school, really deplorable. And so, you know, as a politician type person, you know, I'm going to get you a new school. We're going to build you a new school. Told Percy, that's going to be on our priority when we get to the legislature. We're going to get fund money. And so Alfred then, you know, on the discussion of the dam, the Rampart Dam, he says, that's very interesting, or very, so nice of you that you're going to build my compadres, or he didn't use compadres, but my friends in Fort Yukon, a new school, only to have a few years later come and have it flooded. You know, so it was like, he brought up, like, what's the idiocy of that?
Right.
You know, and so anyway, when he brought up that point and the way Alfred would speak, he was a very eloquent speaker. You know, everybody just laughed. Just some people fell out of their seats. It was so funny the way he kind of illustrated it and embarrassed,
right,
you know, the fellow that was promoting or presenting the ideas of this Rampart Dam. Because I remember other questions that people asked was like, well, what are you going to do with all that power anyway? And they really hadn't thought that far ahead.
Oh, really?
They didn't really. Well, we're gonna create an aluminum factory. Aluminum takes a lot of electricity to make aluminum, you know. So I mean, it could have gone on and on. Like, right. Where are you gonna get the aluminum from? Where, you know? I mean, right. At that time, the Tennessee Power Authority was already up here in Alaska, promoting the idea. Yeah, they were the go-to lead experts on building big power dams in the United States. And if you look at your history, just a few years before this dam project in Alaska was being discussed, Russia had just finished the biggest dam in the world.
Oh.
So it was more of a competition, mm-hmm. of why Alaska was so hell-bent. It wasn't really Alaska, because Alaska really didn't have any. It wasn't even formed here. It was just from Washington, D.C. But, you know, somebody in Washington, D.C. said, hey, the Russians just built the largest dam in the world. Where can we build a bigger dam? And when they looked around the United States, it was either the Mississippi, which you can't really dam. You'd flood, right. You know, after you caught in the United States. Alaska, the Yukon River.
Yukon's the next biggest
river. That's the biggest river in the country, so let's build a dam there. And so.
So were the proceedings at the conference conducted in English or in...
most of it was in English, pretty much everybody spoke.
So I was thinking some of those elders probably didn't speak much English.
Yeah, you know, and as far as the leadership then, they were young men. Alfred Grant was young. Yeah,
okay.
I mean, Robert here, he was young. My dad was young.
So even though the chiefs
Knoll Nuts was now young.
Benedict.
And Benedict Arnold, or Benedict Jones was young. I mean, they're all my dad's. Yeah, he's older than my
Robert
dad.
Robert Jarvie.
Yeah, I think Robert died.
Yes.
He's probably like 5-6 years older than my dad. And I think they're about exactly the same age.
How old's your dad?
He's going to be 90 here. His
you
next
said
birthday.
You just, yeah, we're celebrating.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, so the people, the leaders were speaking English. Mm-hmm.
And that was the age group there, too. Now, he spoke his language. He speaks language. He did not.
Oh, your dad did not speak his language.
I mean, not fluently.
Yeah, but no. Robert and Benedict did.
They did. Only if you lived, you know, if you lived on the highway, like in, you know, Toke or whatever, you know, more likely men in his age group didn't speak or spoke very little of it.
Okay.
But if you were from Fort Yukon or Minto or Nulato, Caltech, yeah, they spoke the language pretty good. But, but that age group of my dad's, that's when they really start to split off of not, you know, not speaking. The missions were still going strong, mm-hmm. you know. The Indiana mission was going up.
Right.
When I was born, it was just at the tail end
right.
of the mission Indiana. They had pretty much shut it down by, let's see, I remember it fell in the river in like 60... For the whole building, you know, the whole building just fell into the river and floated down underneath the railroad bridge, and everybody in the whole town was out watching it. Big two-story.
It was just from erosion
erosion, yeah.
Yeah,
yep, that whole, the whole
yeah I
area.
Always wondered where it was, and that's why I've never seen it, because
yeah,
it's not
right.
there anymore.
It's not there, yeah. There's a lot of pictures of it and everything. And,
well, one of the, and I know, so after the 1962 mm-hmm. conference, you know, your parents continued to be very active.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was my dad. But then at that time, they had decided that, okay, to be a legal structure, we need to form a legal incorporated, you know, to be a legal entity so that people could have their titles and to conduct business. So they elected, you know, Al Ketchler as the... They wanted to call him the chief, you know, the presiding big chief, but his feelings, you know, that's unfortunate you don't get to interview him, because he told me he didn't want to be, that the white man really understand the chiefness, what it really means, because mm-hmm. to be a chief in those days, you know, in the traditional way, it's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're responsible for... And he didn't want that responsibility either. I mean, he knew and understand of it. Because he was actually a chief in Indiana himself. And if it wasn't for his brother Richard, who later became chief after my dad, because my uncle Richard did all his work.
No.
You know, taking care of things, taking
right.
care of business, you know, cutting firewood, hauling water, all that kind of stuff that a chief is responsible for, or delegating other people to do.
I didn't realize the chief was responsible for all that.
Oh, I mean the real tradition of a chief,
right.
like something like, if you know the history of, you know, my dad's auntie, she was married to Chief Thomas, but, you know, the responsibility that he had, I mean, and how he took it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it is illustrated in books and stuff
right.
like that. It's, you know... He would organize the hunting parties, and you're going to go off and do this today. You're going to go fishing. You're going to go get fire. I mean, it was, a chief had lots of authority and responsibility, and you never snap back at a chief. You never question or nothing, you know.
Right.
And but by then, my dad realized that aspect of it was gone in the Native community, that kind of respect that a real chief had.
Right.
You know.
And so...
Chief Isaac was, which my dad didn't really know him that well
mm-hmm.
during the early times, but you know, he was Chief Isaac, and Peter John are the chiefs that I would say in my era still had that aura.
Yeah,
I mean, had that power.
Right.
Of what?
Well, it sounds like Chief Thomas maybe did.
Chief did too.
Yeah,
he most
three.
Definitely. He was
yeah.
too powerful,
yeah.
according to other tribes
oh,
around
yeah.
him. Yeah, he was too. You know, too into himself, you know.
Well, and you know. So that, so out of that meeting in Tanana came the decision to
officially form
Tanana Chiefs Conference.
Yeah, the Nahana. It wasn't called Tanana Chiefs Conference. It was called the Nahana Hanash, which in the translation is the land speaks. That's what it meant. So that's the when you look at the incorporated papers in Juneau, you see the Nahana Hanash. Right. It wasn't until the later on in the and I guess later in the 60s, the newspaper, just everybody complained about it being so long, you know, because right now not even called Tanana Chiefs anymore. It's called TCC.
I was going to say, because Tanana Chiefs Conference is just as long.
That's even, you know, reduced down a lot from what it used to be. And they incorporated under that name and which I have the record somewhere of incorporating papers that were filed. And so they were, you know, off and running. Then Al Sr. had, you know, the authority to, and the responsibility to carry it forward.
And to do what? To land claims?
I mean, based on the resolutions and the power that was given and a direction that, yes, you know, the 32 communities, was it? 28 communities that first attend the meeting were, and there were other villages were there that were not in the TCC region either.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
there was probably a good half a dozen or so. I know, what's his name, from Copper Center was there, another from Metlakatla.
It's interesting that Metlakatla, I know Copper Center because they had a Alaska Native Brotherhood group
in
Copper Center.
Yeah. But they were other ones that came in and, you know, and they went back, relayed. Mr. Gray, I forgot what Gray. He went back and relayed. He became very active in his, you know.
Nick Gray.
And his community, as well as even in when I was finally incorporated under ANCSA, you know, and then his village corporation, he's involved in that. And some of these guys, you know, progressed right on, say similar to, I think the best example is she was really involved from Sitka in the Klinkenhaida land claims movement. And then, she became head of Sea Alaska. And then, but she's also involved, very involved in Chiatica, which is the village corporation of Sitka. So a lot of these early on leaders moved on.
Mm-hmm.
The interior here, it was taken over by kind of a whole new group. Johnny Sackett and Tim Wallace and people like that got involved in the politics. And
Of once it was actually official? Well,
actually official after, this will be after, pretty much going into 72,
So that was after Pat. Well, Johnny Sackett, wasn't he involved in the efforts to get ANCSA passed? Or
he was a college student here at the university he actually had gotten involved, to my knowledge. I haven't heard any recordings or like this from Johnny being interviewed and stuff. But he was a college student, and they were having a centennial, Alaska
centennial. So that's a centennial that would have been 67.
Yeah, that's when they created the
Alaska
the
land.
Village. There was a pretty good-sized village creation there.
For Alaska land?
For Alaska land. And he was solicited as a village boy, that's how he kind of got involved in the community on the state or citywide and statewide, and then he also became involved in the Native land claim. So that was, to me, from 62 to 65, there were a lot of other things that had happened before people like him came along.
Right.
And he still was a college student. He was still on the perimeters, so it wasn't until, to me, I would say in the 70s, early 70s, before ANCSA, that you really started to see his, his involvement and support.
I've heard a lot for families of Native leaders during mm-hmm. claims time, you know, the hardships mm-hmm. and the effect on the household because parents were gone a lot or they were mm-hmm. super busy. Or,
right, right.
And I was wondering what your experience might have been.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, I wasn't until a nurse came to Nenana, it would have been after the flood. So that was in 67.
Right.
And, you know, she was, a nurse would come to our school and, you know, check us all as kids out. And somehow she was connected to the Tanao chiefs. Either Tanao chiefs kind of organized it, even though Tanao chief wasn't really a major administrative mm-hmm. structure yet, you know. That didn't really happen until they got the contract for health aides, you know, in the later 60s. But anyway, so a nurse came to Nenana, and so I went into the room where she's getting checked up, and she looked at my name, and she says, "Alfred, your dad is Al, huh?" And I said, "Yeah." And she says, "You know, your dad's a very, very famous man." And I said, "Really?" And so I remember that kind of stuck.
Yeah. Because it was hard on your dad.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I was, you know, your mom, you know, they were still married at
the time.
Yeah,
they were still married.
And she talked a little bit about that.
Yeah. It was really stressful for him because, you know, and when he was, and he traveled a lot. I mean, he was always on the road promoting within the Native community. Because he, not only head of Tanao chiefs, there was always other people out there to, you know, undermine his what he's doing or what he was not doing.
Right, within the Native community.
Within the Native community, yeah.
Yeah.
It's, nothing's changed on that, of course. But, you know, Minto, I remember one time my mother had to write an eloquent letter to the chief, to the council there, which Frank, with Richard Frank was the chief. And kind of put him back in his place, you know. Mm. Stevens Village is another rogue kind of a mm-hmm. village, you might say, and because they were crucial when they decided to file the blanket claim. And Stevens Village had other people outside the community and flown some that, you know, don't you dare.
And was that claim that was in response to the pipeline?
Yeah, right. Yeah, there were oil interests. There was a lot of interest in. Stevens Village was a crucial on that.
Because they're the closest.
Yeah. And I don't know if my mother's interview talked about that or my dad.
The blanket claim?
The blanket claim, but how Stevens Village, you know, decided to switch and change their mind and become rock solid, yes.
No, I mean, I would hope that I'd be able to talk to your dad and we could go into that.
Right.
And it may still happen, but if you could explain what you know about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was, I remember my dad and mom strategizing on it, and they were talking to Bill Byler, who was, my dad's support. Now, Bill got involved through Association on American Indian Affairs. And he actually took over for Laverne Madigan. Laverne Madigan was here too
at the conference.
Yep. Which in the Native national realm, she was the biggest. You know, that was before other American Indian national organizations were. They might have been created, but they were really nobody. But the association. What was a formidable force?
Yeah,
in a sense of they had. Money, they had New York money backing,
right?
From all kinds of different communities. I got to see the K-Mark family, the heirs of that are major contributions to the American Indians. Now they don't have an ounce of Indian in them,
right.
But they have sat on their board, and I met Jessica Crest. Crest family.
And unfortunately, Laverne died shortly after.
Shortly after, terrible accident. So right. Bill took over.
Well, yeah, and you have. I would have wanted to ask you about Bill. You have mm-hmm. mentioned him, and so
yes.
Talk more about him and his role.
Yeah. Well, he took over as association for after Laverne. I'm not sure how long he lasted. I also think under Bill's leadership at that time, he hired a young attorney fresh out of law school, and Hirsch, Bert Hirsch, Bertram Hirsch, which he is considered probably the most recognized name in Indian law.
Hmm.
Yeah, little Jewish boy. I knew his mother. His mother lived to be, she close to 100, and she stayed with my wife and I before, many years later, back in the middle 90s, yeah. It's the last time I seen her when she came to Alaska to visit. But Bert, he was a good strategist, and him and my mom really clicked. They knew how to talk to each other. And in fact, I think Bill would use my mom to influence my dad. He would say, hey, Lewis, I think you ought to, tell Al to take this position, whatever. And because if you know my dad, he's a very reserved fella, so, and he's hard to even read, sometimes you can, if you're presenting things to him. And I think that's one of his unique negotiating abilities, is that he's a poker player type person. You just don't know what level, what's going to come back or whatever. Mm-hmm. But
he would respond to something from your mom.
From my mom. My
better
mom,
than from Bill Byron.
Yeah, my mom would beat him over the head if she had to. So anyway, Stevens Village had come out publicly that they weren't going to be a part of the... Which they were right in the corridor. They're part of the pipeline.
So the blanket claim was that the lands that the pipeline was going to go over were native lands, were interior native lands.
Yeah, yep. Okay. That basically was Stevens Village, and their blessing on the blanket claim would seal the fate of the pipeline ever being, ever going into another level. It would end up in federal court. That was the biggest concern, was, it end up in federal court. And could be a Supreme Court decision, so you're looking at 5 to 10 years. And and it would take, years and years to settle. And by that time, in the towards the middle to going on to the late 60s, the pipeline aspect was well on its way. A number of people didn't know about it.
Right.
It wasn't until, kind of 72 when all of a sudden, engineers and moving companies and, Fairbanks was just bombarded by 75. It was, things were well on the way.
Well, yeah, but people who know the history of ANCSA, mm-hmm. is that the reason it was able to kind of move forward is because of that... the stay on the lands and saying, hey, you can't build that pipeline until you settle
the land
claim. So the land freeze that Secretary Udall did.
Yeah, well,
that kind of, the blanket claim instigated that?
It most definitely instigated it, but it was one of the best things that ever happened. And so...
And that was your dad's idea? Or Bill?
Well, no, it was kind of Bill. Bill and my mom and dad, they strategized, and Bill said, this is what we need to do. And they said, okay, we're going to hold this meeting in Stevens, and you arrange a charter airplane. We're going to bring a camera person in. We're going to bring a, what's that term they use for somebody recording meetings in those days?
Court recorder?
It's not a court recorder, but it was somebody who specializes just in recording, mm-hmm. I mean, not everybody could record.
Right.
Those are on those reel-to-reels.
Right.
Because we used to have the minutes of that in our house. And so we're going to go up there, and we're going to call, have the counsel there, and we're going to, tell them, okay, you're going to be on camera, and you're going to be there, and we're going to make this presentation to you. And so, anyway, there was a big effort to, prevent the meeting from even happening.
Hmm.
And I heard later on some of the chief then, and why he was so influenced by somebody who Oh yeah, Bill Cardle was the one that stopped that meeting, you know, had put the bug in their ear.
That was,
yeah, you know, you guys are just going to stop the oil pipeline, and you know, and we need that pipeline, Alaska, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it was Bill, and so he had an inline with the chief. So anyway, my dad and Bill Byler came up, and they all flew up to Stevens Village and set everything up. The council came in, and kind of like, you know, put them on the spot. And on the spot in the sense that they realize that they will be in the spotlight there. It's being recorded, it's being videoed, you know, or right. There's a big camera there. In those right. days, there are monster things. And so they went in the executive session, and they came back out and said, "We're on."
So they joined the suit.
They joined the suit. Yeah. And so, you know, I think Bill, if I remember correctly, I think my mom might even have mentioned that he gets the credit, you know, for that particular strategy of getting, you know, getting them, that community on board. Because it really changed, because I remember... Well, after that meeting, it was in the wintertime, so by that following spring, there was a stranger that when I woke up in the morning in our house, and we were living in a big house. My dad had wasn't finished yet, but he had started building this big 1, 2, 3, 4, like a 6, 7 bedroom house for all his kids. There was a stranger sleeping on in a nice suit, and he was, you know, and anyway... My dad, you know, when he got up and stuff, and my dad said, I want to introduce you to the president of ARCO, Harold Hines. And so Harold, I don't know if he was the first, that's the things you have to ask my dad, but he came to my dad and said, "We're going to support you Indians. We want you to get that land."
Oh.
Yeah. So that brought on, you know, by that plan of bank claim, it got the oil companies behind the natives. In a sense, it was just to the oil company, it was just simple: settle with the natives, you know, get it settled. That's, you know, we don't care, you know, what aspect of it. We'll make the deals across the land, you know. And
they wanted to build that pipeline.
They wanted to get that pipeline. That, you know, by right. then it had already been, you know, already been pretty much saying that's exactly what's going to happen.
Right.
So So then I got, you know, years later, I got to serve with Harold, you know, not as president of ARCO, but he was hired by the state legislature to head up the Alaska propane project, pulling propane off the North Slope and getting it to Alaska markets. And so it was...
Well, that's why I've heard his name.
Yeah, it was, a really... You know, not a brilliant man, but, you know, really, he's artistic. He's a really good artist. But, yeah, I never did really. I don't know if he's still alive or not.
I don't know.
I'd have to check. But
mm-hmm. One of the things you and I talked about when we were with your mom and, mm-hmm. and over the phone is this idea that there were, the Native land claims movement mm-hmm. was assisted by non-natives mm-hmm. and they had allies and mm-hmm. advocates.
Oh yeah. And in the beginning, I say they were more non-native supporting of it than the native community. And in the native community, it wasn't that they weren't against it, they just didn't understand it, you know. Because that's one thing that, you know, Alfred Starr, when he you know, was in a mission school, and the teacher, this is the way Alfred kind of described it, when the teacher, the sister, I don't think it was a Catholic school, but the teacher was talking about, you know, Alexander the Great and conquering lands and, you know, the Native American movement, the settlement with the Native Americans for the land and trading for this and that kind of stuff. And so Alfred said it just sent a bug in his ear, and he asked the teacher, "Well, then we must own Alaska then, right?" And the teacher said, "Yes, you do own Alaska. The Native people own Alaska." And so, as you know, as him being in junior high or wherever, how old he was at that time, That was his first education of it. He started, and he was very methodic. I mean, you know, by the time when I was growing up and listening to him in the meetings, he was very rehearsed. Rehearsed in a sense of he had already, during the Depression, he left Alaska and went to the lower 48. And he went to about a half a dozen or a dozen Native American reservations just to investigate how a land settlement would be. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the best approach? And that's how serious he was. I mean, he's the only lone wolf out there in whole Alaska. But that was the rationale for him to go outside before he was married and had any kids. He went out and traveled. He would tell stories about traveling with the hobos, you know, the hobos. And he didn't consider himself a hobo, but he said they fed him well. They treated him good.
He rode the trains.
He rode the trains, and he got around. But he said he went to the reservations, and he just said, oh, my God. You know, they were like prisons. You had to get permission to leave. Wow. Especially some of them, like in the Montanas, you know, they were just hell holes.
Yeah.
The Fort Belknap and the Crow and Blackfeet. I mean, they were just cesspools of nothing, you know. And then all their lands were being leased out to somebody else to harvest timber, mining coal, whatever. You know, every reservation is being exploited one way or another. So he came back very, very determined, you know, that there will be a settlement in Alaska, but it's not going to be in a reservation style, which gave credibility back to the original Judge Wickersham when he had that meeting in Fairbanks, when Hudson Stuck and Bishop Rowe, you know, had brought in all
1915.
Those. Yeah, around 1915, brought in the Fairbanks here. Because of the railroad aspect was coming to fruition, money's being appropriated in Congress to build this railroad, and Hudson Stuck, who had came to Alaska from Texas, he had seen what the railroad had done to the Native Americans in California, just decimated tribes, and he did not want to see that at all. So he convinced Wickersham that we got to call these people together and we got to get them on a reservation, because that's the only way we can protect them. We got to set a land aside. So when all the chiefs of the Tanao Chiefs area came together, by that time, and which is, you know, from the time that Chief Thomas is at this meeting, you know, Chief Thomas had met Captain Morgan just 17 years earlier, early August of 1898, Indiana. The Sternwiller stopped there, and Captain Morgan got out and met him and introduced himself, and they were able to communicate back and forth, as well as Captain Morgan had picked up a translator in Tanana that it was on, he was on board, so to help. This translator, you know, could speak all the different dialects, because they were very, you know, dialects were speaking from different community were different. But so anyway, that was, you know, that's the idea of how the Native land claims would be structured. That's primarily came from Charlie, my grandfather, said, well, why don't we set up corporations? Let's do corporations and everybody be a shareholder. Everybody have an equal say. Corporations are just like a tribe. But, you know, the tribe would not be confounded, because that was another aspect of, you know, like my dad didn't want to be the chief of Tanao Chiefs. Because the chiefs had so much power and, you know, just they didn't want to let somebody have that kind of power anymore that they could trust. And so anyway, that was kind of the born of, hey, you know, the corporations, you know, is a potential vehicle to look at. And so eventually that kind of concept got to Congress, and you know, over the course of number of years, it was refined out, and then they, you know, sat down and broke out different, you know, broke up Alaska mm-hmm. amongst the different ethnic groups, indigenous groups, and passed, you know, historical legislation.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, as we've said, that the these names you've mentioned, you know, mm-hmm. Bill Byler and Mary Alice Miller and Sandy Jensen, your yeah. grandfather, your mom, mm-hmm. were kind of the behind the scenes people that mm-hmm. I don't think their names get recognized.
Yeah. They don't, and that's unfortunate because they're you know, there was an attempt after the ANCSA to start up a Native Land Claims College.
Hmm.
In fact, Tanoc Chiefs kind of did. They had a whole other structure for that. And it was, you know, they at that time, the leadership felt it was really important that the young people learn mm-hmm. the history, because it was an education for the Native community, too. You know, that yeah. the whole land claim structure was not just born out of an ideal, but it's an ideal that was generated hundreds of years ago back in Europe.
Right.
That a country can take over another country, but they cannot take over their culture. They can't dissipate their language. They can't integrate them, you know, that. And so, anyways, it was a very, you know, it's a really big picture as far as mm-hmm. the history of the legal basis of the settlement in Alaska, because all those aspects were used right. and made logical, you know, to, you know, I mean, everybody was, you know, had their own different perspectives on it, right down to Richard Nixon, the president at the time. He, you know, and I, you know, when I heard the story, I didn't really know why he would say that until I read of his book, you know, many years later, his book came out. But, you know, he told Don Wright that, "Don, I have nothing against Native Americans. I, as you know, in my legislation, I've given back more land to Native people," which he did in New Mexico and other mm-hmm. states. And he says, "I want Alaska Native people to have their land back. And you get me legislation on my desk, and I'm going to sign it without question." And he told that to Don Wright probably in, you know, 1970 or so, two or three years earlier.
Right.
But, you know, knowing now of his own personal history right. through his book, you know, his football coach right. was a Native American fella.
Yeah.
And so that heavily influenced him, himself.
Well, you had mentioned the corporate structure mm-hmm. And I do wanted to ask you about your assessment of the Settlement Act and mm-hmm. the corporations and
mm-hmm.
how you think that has worked or hasn't
yeah,
worked.
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as something that is so, you know, so out there, and, you know, from the concept, and the concept, because always has been, you know, the American concept, you know, created under the Department of Interior. What do you, you know, Department of Interior was to decide, was created kind of decide what we're going to do with the Indian problem,
right?
You know, and so the Indian problem, the way the American government handled that situation, you know, led to, you know, a lot of anguish to the Native American people, be it the Trail of Tears or the decimation of the American or the tribes in California, or even westward through Montana and Oregon and the coast. You know, if you read Lewison's account,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the American Indians helped them very much. They were
right.
very much alive, and so, you know, coming up with the new concept of a corporation and shareholders and everybody have an equal share and an equal vote, overall has worked, I think, pretty good. You know, now there is some flaws in it, and it was interesting because I remember having a conversation with Senator Stevens in the middle 80s because he was concerned. It was a concern at the beginning by people like Senator Stevens after the land claims has passed, because everybody under the sun was here in Alaska. When Doyon would have a meeting, there'd be Saudis there. Mm-hmm. There were Jewish businessmen from New York. I mean, there was everybody there ready to sell you something or have you buy something or whatever. I mean, look at one of the first investments Doyon made. Do you know what they made investment?
The asbestos.
Well, yeah, that was actually a little bit later. They're one of the first ones. They bought a hotel in Hawaii.
Oh, right.
Yeah. The Pioneer Inn.
I forgot that was the,
Yeah. I went to visit that. I was stationed in the Marine Corps in Hawaii, and I flew over to Maui and just to see my what my investment was. And But, so anyway, money was flying around all over Alaska. And, a lot of corporations, including Doyon, got so sucked up that under just lack of business knowledge, they, the poor advice, some of them really got suckered.
Yeah.
And Doyon, was one of the biggest corporations that fell to their knees.
Oh, it did, yeah.
It fell to the knees, yeah. Siri fell to his knees. But there was always these bright stars out there where Southeast, Sea Alaska was doing good. Siri was doing good. Arctic Slope was doing good. And Nana wasn't doing too bad. So when you look at the big picture, of all the regional corporations, there were some pretty sad stories. And that's one reason why Senator Stevens created NOLs.
NOLs, what is that?
Yeah, let's see, NOL stands for...
Net Operating Loss,
yeah. Yep. And that saved Doyon. They already had so much loss in their books. They invested into a company out of Texas that they were, going to go in competition against MAPCO. Mm-hmm. Because I had met somebody at MAPCO. They used to sponsor some of my basketball tournaments. And they always, where I had a dinner meetings with them, they had always asked the question, why didn't Doyon partner with us? We asked them. But the leadership at the time said, no, we're going to do our own thing. We're going to develop our own oil refinery and all that kind of stuff. And in which it fell on nothing was bid ahead. All the land in North Pole, next to MAPCO, they had bought all kinds of equipment. But by then, the millions and millions were spent. And nobody, when certain people, key people left, and there wasn't the key people to begin with that knew what they were doing, they knew how to, act like what they're doing as far as oil industry. I mean, oil development is either on the refinery level or development level. It's a very complicated,
Well, Doyon Drilling has...
That would merge later. That was under Morris Thompson's reign that he... luckily the oil companies came to him and said, hey, here's a niche we think that you ought to be in. And he hired the right people. Well, I think the oil companies might even gave him the right people and developed, a very successful mainstay business, mm-hmm. Is that. But that was years later after Morris Thompson came into the picture.
Are there things that you think should have or could have happened mm-hmm. with in Angska and land claims that didn't?
Well, each region has done different things over time, mm-hmm. but I came when I got out of the Marine Corps in 78, went right into college. So summer of 78. I was an intern at Tanau Chiefs, and I traveled, to all the villages in the interior. So I got to meet, all these people that all of them knew my dad.
Right.
And some of them would say pretty much plain blank, God, your dad sold us a bill of goods. Here I am, an old man. I'm thinking of John Deacon maybe in Grayling. He was, when I met him, he was 94, 95 or something like that. And he, so what has this native land claim stuff done for me? he had gotten a few checks, you know, when the land claims passed, Doyon passed out some money, the village corporations got some money, but you know, overall, you know, it was nothing. The native people, the older elders, didn't feel they were leaving any legacy behind. You know, they didn't have a nest egg. They didn't have any land. And to them, they thought 100 shares, a piece of paper, was worthless.
Right.
Yeah. Now, that's different today. Now, you know, through inheritance and things like this, I realize that 100 shares and any regional corporations is gold, you know, mm-hmm. it's money. And so but every corporation has been a little bit different. I mean, there's corporations in on the North Slope area that pass out dividends on a quarterly basis, and it's enough to live on for yeah. somebody to live a comfortable life. You know, similar to the Pequots, you know, that have the casino in Connecticut and that old naval base. They get $300,000-$400,000 a year from the gambling proceeds, and they all have beautiful homes. They have their own neighborhoods, their own mm-hmm. educational and health care, and they've, you know, managed it and developed it right. But the other parts of Alaska, you know, they weren't so fortunate, you know.
Right.
But I see, you know, as I, you know, I always, wherever I travel and I have other friends live in other areas, I always say, could you send me your financial statements from your regional corporation? And I read them over, and, you know, in a lot of cases I see progression. You know, ones that like Siri, that hotel in Anchorage, right. that lost it. I mean, it was really down. NOLs mm-hmm. came back in, got them back on their feet again. New leadership came in, and whammo, I mean, it's very prosperous. They're international now. I mean, they do a lot of neat things. So there's more success stories out there under this model mm-hmm. than there is the sad stories.
Okay.
You know, and Doyon is not a sad story. It's just there could be so much more that could be done.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a tremendous land base that is not even scratched yet, really.
Right. Well, and I was wondering, yeah, what the... Are there negative consequences of going with that corporate way in terms of, you know, traditional values and cultural preservation and mm-hmm. and how leadership has dealt with that?
Yeah. Then there was confusion and time for a long time that there was a thought that the corporations had extinguished their Aboriginal rights, mm-hmm. and which meant their hunting rights and their fishing rights and clean water and all that stuff, but it, you know, as they're learning now, it didn't. It has that's totally two separate things. Yeah, but somehow, for a while there, they was like they were like commingled when they shouldn't be commingled.
Well, but I thought in Aimska that it did extinguish Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights, mm-hmm. and then that's led to the whole. Then Anilka, they tried to get it all back with Title VIII and subsistence,
right.
and then the whole state federal. Battle over subsistence.
Right. Yeah. That was.
But so what's the
when it was clarified, because you know the state of Alaska, state of Alaska does not recognize Indian tribes.
Right.
But when Ada Deer, you know, came into play, and you know one of her first missions when she got appointed, and Alaska delegations went down there, and Tanau Chiefs was part of that party at that time. You know, said, hey, you know, we have to be federally recognized, our tribes up here. And and we had Senator Stevens on board,
right.
you know, to start funding. In fact, you know, Senator Stevens, after that, created the Small Tribes Funding Resource. So every tribe in Alaska gets $110,000 for operating cost. And that's still in play today.
Hmm.
It's written right into... But you know, so you know, Ada Deer, you know, through putting Alaska Native tribes on the federal registered list,
mm-hmm.
and then having it, you know, authenticated that yes, they're your Alaskan tribes here. And they didn't, and Alaska tribes didn't have to go through the arduous process of becoming a declared Indian tribe because there's probably a dozen or more tribes in Lower 48 that have been for the last 50 years trying to get themselves federally recognized.
Right.
But, you know, Alaska was just like that. Just took the right person, the right time,
and so what
the right president.
Yeah, what difference has that made to have a tribal...
Oh, boy, it made all the difference in the world. Yeah, it gave the villages stability to develop their own infrastructure, you know, to grow off of. Because off of that, housing came into play. Village safe water, you know, there are all kinds of other programs, healthcare that gave the tribes, they eventually, after they got that recognition, the tribes went, hey, you know, we can do more. We can take care of our own healthcare. So give us, so a lot of tribes, Fort Yukon, Tanana, a number of them in interior, they take care of their own healthcare. So, you know, they hire their own doctors, their own dentists.
So that's different than the federal contracting.
Yeah, it's just part of federal contracting, but it relates back to being federally recognized.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because those are things that the corporations can't do.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. And then how does that work with the corporations and the tribes and how they, you know, get along or
Yeah, you know, that's the strange things, you know, because in some regions of Alaska, I see the tribes and the corporation, I mean, they're hand and foot.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know... I think in the interior, I remember going to a meeting, and it was such a neat meeting. I went to a tribal council meeting, which I was invited to as a Tanaw chief's representative. And so one of the person says, "Hey, Bear, could you wait a little bit? We're going into our city council meeting." And said, "Okay, I'll stay and listen to a city council meeting." And I waited for other people to come in, and then they started a meeting. It was a tribal
people.
Yeah. And then they said, we should have a village corporation meeting because we have this one issue to be resolved. And they went into the village corporation. They were all the same people. I think maybe one new person came in as far as the village came.
Yeah.
But everybody knew what was going on. Everybody, you know, was on the same page. And, you know, so there was, you know, true cooperation there.
Well, it does sound very complicated, all those lands.
Yeah, it is.
There's the tribe and their council, and then in some cases there's a city.
Yeah, and they over contradict each other.
A village corporation and then a regional
corporation.
So how do they
And that's the sad thing is, it is kind of complicated, but I think it's just, like I said, in some areas of Alaska, you know, some other regional corporations, they have been able to master that. And I'll just use Arctic Slope as being one of them, and UIC, their village corporation. Mm-hmm. The village corporation told ARC, hey, we want to be in this game. We want to build houses. We want to use our tribal health consortium monies and all that kind of stuff. And so they work together, and ARC gives them money to help meet the grant requirements and stuff. So there's a wonderful partnership. And so with the village corporation then works over here supporting the tribal college, you know, so it's a really
And ASRC does other things.
And they do other international things, military contracts to do.
And then the North Slope Borough does.
And the North Slope Borough is, you know, another thing that they all, you know, work really good. There's a lot of times they're the same people on different boards.
But then also there's city. Yeah, it's just, it seems like so many layers of
there
bureaucracy.
Is. Yeah, there is. And that's.
Is that really necessary?
Yeah. Is it necessary? If there was a spirit of the cooperation, it would all work just wonderfully. But when I looked around how we're going to save our rural schools, you know, for funding, you know, especially under conditions like this pandemic or whatever, and the funding dropping, stuff like that. And, you know, there's no borough schools in rural Alaska, you know.
Except for the North Slope.
Except for the North Slope and Valdez and Fairbanks. Mm. But there's 100 and some odd miles of pipeline that's untaxed. The state of Alaska gets those proceeds.
Oh.
So I had worked with a number of different communities to say, let's incorporate a borough around this just to fund our education. Let's just make this similar to what Valdez does. Valdez is probably the best example. They take the largest percentage, and so does actually the Arctic Slope Borough. They take a large percentage of that, give it to the education.
Right.
And so, but anyway, it's the spirit of cooperation in the interior is just not there. And part of it is just what ANCSA had kind of created, and not really created, but it was already there, was the mistrust of other different tribes. You know, there was reason why they had tribal wars. There was reason why they had different hunting disputes and whatever. And, you know, and so again, the spirit of cooperation, working together, clear the goals and whatever, it's really hard to do and when you get tribal groups and municipalities and, you know, the Doyon tries to keep out of that stuff. They always trying to distance themselves. It is.
Well, and that's one of the things that is mentioned with land claims movement is the unity that it required for statewide
Alaska
to get that
amazing
to pass,
how they came
that,
together.
That the native communities had to unify and come together. But then I've heard that.
Well, there was a lot of distinction on the level of Washington, D.C. when they're, you know. That's why I think that, or I believe, that Etok and my dad, they saved the day, you know. There was a bill introduced to give the natives 10 million acres of land and I forget how many billions of dollars. I'd have to ask more of a scholar type person who was, my dad would probably remember. And so, anyway, looks like everybody was on board. You know, even the delegates, other delegates from interior here. But one thing they had a rule about in Washington that everybody, they practiced, you know, the seven civilized tribes, mantra in a sense of one disagreement kills the whole thing. So they agreed that at the beginning that everybody have to be agreed before we go to Senator Jackson and Udall and them to say, okay, this is what we want.
So AFN was sort of the group that was agreeing? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that would be kind of considered like the AFN. By then, the AFN was kind of like the vocal point with all the different regional representatives that were there. And so anyway, when the idea was presented that they were going to settle for much less than what they had proposed, you know, Al Senior, you know, I remember he called my mom and my mom said, no way, we're not going to sell Alaska Natives down the road for that little. And so he went to Etok because he looked around and, you know, everybody was like, okay, they were all had money stars in their eyes and, oh boy, let's get this over, we can get out of Washington. There was a lot of different personal political aspects of it. And so Al went to Etok and talked to Etok, because at that time Etok, I think, was kind of like neutral. And Etok says, Al, I'm going to back you this time. We're not going to, the Arctic Slope region is not going to settle for this. Because he was a representative of Arctic Slope, you know, which is amazing in itself, but he had that responsibility. And so anyway, he went back and, oh God, they were mad at Al Senior and Etok. Ooh boy. You're going to ruin it for, we're going to get less now. That was the whole thing. And so that's when it kind of glued, like, what is our bottom line? And they said, okay, you know, 40 million acres is our bottom line. You know, about 10% of Alaska. We're giving up all this other lands and then the cash settlement part, which I don't know if they actually had a number at that time, but during the negotiating process or not, but, you know, eventually it was settled at about $1 billion.
Well, yeah, and I've also heard that something that Etok said kind of after passage was, well, now, because of how it was set up for the corporations, that it was going to pit native groups against native groups.
He did talk a lot about that, and if anything... I don't know if it was purposely or whatever on Etok, because he's kind of hard to read. I mean, I've known him since the 70s, right. And I knew him in his drinking days, and I knew him in his sober days, and he's not only an eloquent speaker, he educates himself very well. Mm-hmm. He understands the world. He understands indigenous rights. But he would bring up, you know, sometimes he made things much more complicated than they should be. Mm-hmm. That's in other words. One aspect, I think, that he lost a lot of credibility, you know, through, is that people did, during his addiction years, seeing him as kind of a cop-out, you know. Because his good buddy, Jonathan Solomon, who him and I used to be housing commissioners, mm-hmm. we would travel together to the Lower 40. He always wanted to travel with me and stay in a hotel room with me and stuff like that. So him and Etok were good, very good drinking buddies. Mm-hmm. They weren't buddies after they quit, but they were. He was just amazed of how, you know, how Etok understood the system, you know.
Yeah.
And he took advantage of it more than one occasion. Yeah. Hmm. And so when the Native people, you hear that, he lost a lot of credibility. And I could see why even the Arctic Slope region kind of pushed him away. But if you understand addiction and stuff like that, I mean, it's just a desperate guy wanting a fix.
Right.
And he knew where to get his fix from.
Right.
Which he had milked the oil companies, mm-hmm. you know. He would go into an oil company's office and pound on their table. Because John would say, what the hell are we doing in this, Chevron USA office in Seattle? You know, I don't belong here, whatever. And Etok said, watch me. Jonathan said one time he was in there screaming, hollering. And he said, well, sit down, Mr. Etok, in the lobby. Then they'd come out, can we talk to you again? And he'd come back and in the lobby. Jonathan would stay there. He wasn't a part of the conversation with the oil executives. And they came out with a check to his name for $40,000. And said, okay, here's some money, Mr. Talk. Have a good day. And they opened the elevator for him as he left. And so then John said it took him 2 or 3 months to party that money away. And, mm-hmm. you know, but anyway, that word got around.
Yeah.
And that undermined his personal credibility, which is if people understand addiction, that's, right. you know, but he got his fix.
One, as you say, he knew. By threatening the oil company.
No, he would threaten them that he would
with a lawsuit or something.
Yeah, he would tell them you know, things that they would make them, you know, I'll get Arctic Slope to stop you from oil development, right.
So they would pay him off.
They'd pay him off. So, you know, I mean, really, to a certain degree, when I look at that, and I think when I first heard the story, you know, I was thinking, you know, the oil companies are just as corrupt and dirty as he was, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you say, he knew how to work the system.
He knew how to work it, you know.
Yeah.
And so the oil companies knew how to work it.
You know, and I've heard the stories that during, you know, the land claims times, mm-hmm. yeah, he would, you know, make big productions and get a lot of attention mm-hmm. and stir the pot.
Yeah.
You know, and it was intentional,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it worked.
Oh, it did, yeah. You know, I should have my dad tell you this story because he tells it the best. But we were in a New York, or no, in a Washington D. Upscale restaurant. They all had kind of a successful day. The whole group of mm-hmm. going and lobbying, so they got together with other bunch of guys and gals, and let's go out and have a nice dinner tonight. So they went. What's a good, you know? So they picked a steakhouse, you know, probably on Capitol Avenue or an L Street or one of the mm-hmm. upper scale. Places, and they get in there, and Etok, you know, they're taking their orders. You know, my dad's, he likes medium rare steak, and they get to Etok, and they say, what do you would, how would you like your steak cut, sir, and or cooked? And he said, just bring it to me raw. And the waiter had to pause and said, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't catch you. How would you like your steak cooked? Just bring it to me, uncooked, raw, right on a plate with all the trimmings and stuff. And so anyway, the second time when the waiter asked Etok like you pointed out, he would get the attention of everybody.
Right.
So the whole restaurant kind of stopped, like, who's this goofball ordering the raw steak, you know?
Right.
You know, and of course, they're looking at him, and some people might know that he's, you know, an Alaska Native, and a lot of Alaska Natives eat raw meat. But
right.
So anyway, they did bring out the steak to him, and the whole kitchen staff had to come out of the kitchen while he was being delivered this raw steak. And right in front of him, he cut it open. He cut it up and ate it, you know. And they were just looking at each other like, oh, my God. You know, but after that, he was a famous guy in that restaurant. They would welcome him back. Oh, you're a great guy.
He did it for effect.
He took it to his advantage.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and I say, like, in the political scene with land claims, mm-hmm. if you got one guy out here being the super radical, mm-hmm. you know, sort of with the settlement
right.
idea, like, well, we want billions and billions and billions,
mm-hmm.
that then makes the...
Yeah.
You know, well, 1 billion seem reasonable now.
Right. Well, that's what's part of, you know, Etok's mantra after the native land claims was, and he realized himself that, hey, we gave up too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, that was his major MO. And he thought he could make it up in other ways, you know, trying to convince other people through tribal governments and things like this. And I don't see any really after effect of what, you know, his promotion was or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, except for, you know, getting the federal recognition, you know,
right.
I mean,
that was part of it.
That was part of his MO in a sense, you know, that ANCSA did not destroy our federal trust relationship mm-hmm. with the federal government. And
well, and this idea of the regions being pitted against the regions, which was his sort of prognosis at the time of passage. Do you feel that that's happened?
No, not really, no.
Okay.
I mean, there is a sense, there is kind of a sense of competition, you might say, within the region. And that was one of the, you know, during Morris Thompson's time, they formed this executive club. And that's literally what it was at the beginning. Of regional corporations presidents, they would all get together
mm-hmm.
in Anchorage at the Hilton, and they would in there. And some of the stupid deals, I remember Morris telling me some. I said, "Well, God, why would you, you know, agree to that?"
Mm-hmm.
But one of the deals that I remember the most was that no regional corporation would invest in somebody's other corporation's domain.
Oh,
like, you know, because at that time Anchorage was growing gangbusters and stuff. You know, we're telling Maury, you know. God, you know, the old companies are having buildings built down there. We need more, you know, skyscraper housing and hotels and, you know, what? Oh, no, we can't take Doyon money and do that. We can do it anywhere else in our region or outside. But, you know, that's a corporate etiquette. I'm like, oh, my God, what kind of agreement is that? But, you know, as later on that I learned I had a study done once when I was head of the planning department at Dan Aljeeves, and I had Brian Rogers do a financial impact statement of the economics, how much of the Native community's economics integrate into the Fairbanks
economy.
And I didn't know it at the time, but when that report came out, Siri and Arctic Slope owned more assets and more land than Doyon did in Fairbanks.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a wake-up call for them. I remember taking that report over to the Doyon and saying, hey, you know, did you know that, you know, Arctic Slope...
So that agreement...
Not everybody's practicing it, you know.
Yeah.
No.
It was a gentleman's handshake.
It would have been at that time as gentleman. I don't know. I don't think it's in place.
No,
I
no,
hope
no,
not
no.
anymore.
Well, I just have a couple more questions.
Okay.
I'm taking up a lot of your afternoon and family stuff starting to happen. I've got actually lots of questions.
No, we'll
but
we'll
one
come
of
back
them
again.
Is, you know, growing up
mm-hmm.
in your early years around all that
right.
land claims activity within the household.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going to those meetings and hearing all that, how do you see that influenced you and what mm-hmm. you went on to do?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, for you know, when the Native Land Claims passed, I was still in high school and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my dad, you know, when he was, you know, given his 2 cents about, you know, what us kids should do, you know, and growing up and whatever. And he really stressed, well, we're going to need accountants. You know, we're going to need business-minded, you know, mm-hmm. leadership. This ANCSA is going to be for the generation of the young people growing up right now that are going to go to college and get mm-hmm. their degrees and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I had already been, my mind kind of made up on 2 things. One is that I had a cousin in '69 killed in Vietnam. Mm. And that made me really curious about the military. And, you know, I wanted to find answers, I guess you might say. Why was my cousin, you know, and I wish that I would have known at that time, you know, because I was thinking, you know, some, what do they call in the Marine Corps, gook. That was a term they given, but a Viet Cong person.
Yeah.
You know, killed my cousin, you know, why, especially knowing that my cousin had a tough time being in Vietnam and killing Vietnamese people. He was actually, his job was a corpsman. So he didn't really, you know, go into combat. He was in combat, you know, but he was more trying to take care of people. And but anyway, it just still had a major impact on him. And so I had kind of made up my mind. And then I had, in high school, I had met Bruce Panowski, who was the state trooper in Indiana. And so I had another, my best buddy, who we ended up going to the Marine Corps together. He's, you know, kind of convinced us that you guys would be great state troopers, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we said, what do we do to be a state trooper? And he says, well, you know, he said, do like me. I went in the Air Force. And I went out of the Air Force. When I retired, I was solicited by the state troopers, went to the academy, and now I'm a state trooper. Mm-hmm. So I had this vision of going into the Marine Corps from watching Jack Webb, I suppose, you know, the DI and other Marine Corps, you know. And then, in high school, I joined the Marine Corps. Oh. I went into the reserves while I was in high school. And then my best friend in high school, which he had more scholarships than anybody could count, you know, to go to college. He was the valedictorian of the school. He informed me one day that he was going to go into the Marine Corps with me. Yeah. And so I said, no, you're not. You know? and sure enough, I loaned him my motorcycle, and he went to Anchorage, and he went and got his physical and stuff, and came back and told me he joined up. Wow. And that he was going to go in earlier than me. Wow. And so he went in the Marine Corps, and that's a whole nother story, but he committed suicide soon after he got out. It was too much of a, even he didn't go to Vietnam either, but it was a major impact.
And if you were stationed in Hawaii?
We were both stationed in Hawaii, yeah. He was the number, when he went to school, he was the number one student in his class, and you get to pick anywhere you want to go in the world. And when I graduated, I was number 2, and there were luckily 2 slots.
Oh, good.
For Hawaii.
Yeah.
So me and the 2 top students to pick.
You didn't have to go to Vietnam.
We didn't. Now, we were still in Vietnam, but the Marine Corps, we had what we called mop-up crews. Mm-hmm. We're over there throwing helicopters off the, you know, off the airport transporters. Oh, right. We were destroying tanks. We're just mop-up, was just destroying everything we're going to leave behind.
Right.
And, you know, pulling out.
Okay.
And
so you spent 4 years in the Marine Corps?
75, 76, 77, and I got out in December of 77, so almost 3 years. Okay. I got out early to go to college. You could put in requests, and Marines were dropping out left and right out of the Marine Corps. I think they were losing like 20,000 men a year or something.
So you came back to Fairbanks?
I came back and went right into college. So I got out off the airplane, and 2 weeks later I was on campus with goals of, that was where the State Trooper Academy was.
Oh, really?
It's in Sitka, yeah.
Right.
Selden Jackson.
Right.
And then, you know, I wanted to play basketball because I had started playing basketball, you know, on a really competitive in the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay.
And when I even tried out for the Marine Corps basketball team, and, you know, I don't know what I ranked, but I was considered to be pretty good. And it's unfortunate that my training in basketball through high school was I was a forward, strong forward or center, and I never did play guard. But in the Marine Corps, when you're playing with guys that were 6'8", 6'10", they were the centers, and they were expecting me to be a guard, and I didn't have the training to be a good guard. So,
So did you go into the Trooper Academy?
No, I went to college, and
at UAF or at Sheldon Jackson?
At Sheldon Jackson, I went there for a couple of years. And then when I came up, I met a girl in Sitka. We eventually married. I met her in October. We were married in February. And she was still in high school. And so I needed to find employment. And then we were expecting a child, my oldest boy, Donovan. And so I just kind of got into the workforce. But the Fairbanks School District were looking for teachers. Mm. And so a friend of mine, Dick Ferris, said, hey, you know, you would be a wonderful teacher, you know, a junior high teacher. And I thought, God, you know what? I love basketball. I love, you know, love kids. So I, you know, went and applied. And sure enough, I got a job teaching junior high. And so it wasn't, you know, probably by October, I realized that, you know, teaching is not, you know, my cup of tea. and mainly because I had such good teachers myself in high school. I had wonderful, dedicated 100%, their whole life is around teaching. And I had, you know, I had grander things that, you know, as well as, you know, kids had changed a lot. I mean, you know, what my thinking of junior high, what I was thinking about, because that was always relating of, God, was I thinking like that when I was in junior high? And because these kids were, we weren't even talking that way in high school, in senior in high school.
It's different, like, village versus urban. So, but eventually you did get into.
I did, and I left
corporation
school, or, you know, teaching after a year. I got a job where I did my summer internship at Tanau Cheese in the Natural Resources Department. And I was hired to direct the agricultural program. And that's how I got my foot back, you know, back into working at Tanau Cheese and back traveling again. So I got back there in 82.
Okay.
And so I worked, you know, up until about 98 or something like that. 99, spent many, many years there in different capacities within TCC structure.
Mm-hmm. And then, did you work for Doyon?
I never worked for Doyon. No, I was.
And then you were chief in Enana for a while?
I was the tribal administrator in Enana, when Charlie Stevens was the chief. And I had a great time there. Truly knew that, learned the term, you can't do good things in your homeland. You know, it was tough.
Yeah.
But it was the funnest work that I ever had done as far as, you know, working. I always told some of my friends in Enana that if I had a second chance, this is what I would do, you know, which was pretty simple. Was what I did when I got out of high school. Get out of town, you know, grow up, learn some new things. But you know, when I took over the tribe, there were 28 young men and women that were. There was this program that provided financial support, kind of like welfare, I guess, you know. And so, anyway, I spent a lot of my energy getting them off that program and on their own, sustained, off to school, got a couple in the military, you know. Yeah, anyway, that's was enjoyable time.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, I mean, certainly your family background, some of it rubbed off on you.
Yeah, it did.
And, you know, being involved in Native issues.
Right, right.
the Native government, or however you want to say it.
I know one aspect that I thought I would do, because my dad had the same job that his dad had, which was head of the Ice Classic. And you know, because his dad was Richard Ketzler Sr. He was always involved in kind of financial aspect. Not only his craftsmanship was, he's a shipwright. He built the steamer Nenana. He was the head crew member on that. That's how he got to Nenana, actually, was he learned that they're building boats in Nenana. And he had that craft as a kid growing up in Germany. And he gave up on looking for gold in Alaska and trekked his way from Flat, which is Ron McGrath area, made it to Nenana. And right away they realized there's a boat building skill guy, and they hired him on the spot. He worked in Nenana for years. But he also, in the wintertime, he was part of that creating, the Nenana Ice Classic.
Well, I think the current administrator, I think she's retiring.
She's leaving, but she was there for years.
I know,
years.
So there you go. There's an opening.
Yeah, well, they already hired somebody, But so
you could fulfill that.
Yeah, but, when they hired her, I knew she's going to be there for 20, 30 years, because
she's done a great job.
Perfect for the job. Yeah, she was.
This is another sort of big question. We've kind of touched on it, but I thought I would ask it as one question.
Yeah.
Which is, how would you assess your dad's contributions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the overall. Yeah,
I mean, if it
wasn't for him, it wouldn't have happened. You know, something might have later on, probably would have been, Senator Stevens didn't really get into power until the, because everything worked, time-wise, everything is in timing, it wasn't just like Nixon being in there as president, Senator Stevens, getting his Senate seat, and, during the Native Land Claim, he was just a junior guy, he was not a big player. He had a lot of Strong Thurmond. I mean, he had a whole Tip O'Neill. Right. He had a lot of big boys that spent hundreds of years of legislative experience. Right. And he was just, but, he paired up with his good buddy, his best buddy throughout his whole life, Senator Inouye. Mm-hmm. And those guys working together moved mountains, and really took Alaska to a whole nother level, Just as Senator Inouye did the same for Hawaii.
Right.
He did a lot of health care and all that kind of stuff. And, I think if Al, as time went on, eventually there would have been something that would have, who knows what it would have looked like, because Charlie's influence, he kind of dropped out, I'd say, by, he left the state, I'm trying to think what year it was, 68, 69, he left the state.
Your dad?
No, my grandfather.
Oh, your grandfather. Yeah.
And he had a little dinky Toyota pickup truck, and he left here. And for, I don't know how long, maybe a year or more, he traveled all over the United States going to Quaker meetings and promoting the indigenous causes of Alaska. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these churches would give him a little bit of money. Most of the times they didn't. He just did it on his own. And persuaded a lot of people to write letters to their congressmen, which in the archives there is a lot of little Quaker ladies writing to their senators, from Kansas and Missouri and Montana, where all the Quakers are at, and about talking about, the settle with the indigenous people of Alaska. And so he was a part of that, and then he landed in, he bought a house in True Street, one of the biggest streets in Kansas City. Mm. I think I'm saying it right, True Street, Troost. I've been to his house when he was living in Kansas. And so he kind of dropped out. So that influence of him, the Native Land Claims was really moving along, but he wasn't involved in, say, the end of it. But
your dad
Well, my dad was...
Do you know what maybe... I mean, this is a question for your dad, but how he kept motivated to keep going?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of the different little hurdles, you know, like when the oil company stepped in, you know, and said, you know, we're going to back you guys, you know.
Right.
And, you know, it was... There was always something... There was many setbacks, but there was always something that would keep him involved and moving forward. Mm-hmm. And as well as my mother would let him stop. There right. was many times that he wanted to quit. He got a job in construction one summer, building a bridge across Nenana. Mm-hmm. You know, and he made the most money in years, you know, mm-hmm. driving as a Teamster, that truck, hauling gravel for the bridge. And that was really nice, where he just got up in the morning and went to work, and
right.
you know, he had money in his pocket. And so that was in 67, 68, around, you know, that when they were mm-hmm. building that bridge. And so yeah, there was times he wanted to drop out. It was getting burnt out, stressed out.
Right.
But in the other aspect, Alaska-wise, he was so ingrained and he was so looked at that, you know, they would hold up meetings until he got there. You know, I mean, that's,
yeah.
you know, he you know, became a very integral part of the whole thing. So,
right.
yeah. But, you know, but that's why I would hope that you get a chance to talk
yes.
to him. Because I mean, I kind of know some of his feelings. He's upset in some ways the way things have turned out,
mm-hmm.
but I know in other things he's very proud mm-hmm. of there, and I know he lost, you know, one of my brothers passed away, mm-hmm. that really kind of set him back a little bit, you know, when he lost my brother to
right.
cancer, lung cancer, smoking, and and the other aspect of it, Alex, my brother, said, you know, I want all my nieces and nephews to get my shares.
Mm.
You know, so he got to divvy out some of the stuff that, you know, what my dad created.
Nice. That's really nice. Well, I'm going to thank you mm-hmm. for today. I know your household is getting
yeah.
ready for dinner and
yeah.
everything, and I don't want to be in the way. So I okay. really appreciate it. And I can tell the great influence your dad has had on you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's very special.
Right. It is, yeah. yeah. I know I used to feel that I had competition, you know, because he had a circle of friends that I know now that were, you know, they all came to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not a guy that get up and go visit you, unless it's one of his brothers. He loved his brother Hank, especially, and his brother Richard. Gilbert, he was the you know, the big guy of the family. He was very independent-minded and,
mm-hmm.
and amazing character. But so like Mitch Dimenoff,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were talking one time, and he said something like, "But my dad," and I said, "Oh, that's my dad." And he said, "No, your dad. Your dad's my dad." He says, "I look at your dad as my dad."
Oh.
So Mitch is kind of telling me, you know, like, you're going to have to share him, you
yeah.
know. And there's other people that looked at him the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were a lot of people looked at him
yeah,
as a solid
tough.
Rock support
yeah,
person.
And that'd be tough to share.
Yeah. I mean, I it was, you know, but as I got older, I see how, you know, that and why that,
mm-hmm.
you know, why he, because he's a very devoted friend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has friends that will, you know, fly from both ranges, just come up and visit him for a few
right.
days, you know.
Well, and also, you know, for you, maybe the shadow of him
mm-hmm.
could have been a challenge as well. But
oh, and it was, yeah, yeah. And I used some of it to my advantage. I got lots of stories of where I impersonated him.
Oh.
You know, especially, you know, on the governmental level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a young lady that was had a scholarship to go to the Indian Santa Fe school
mm-hmm.
for
art
school,
right.
yeah. And she was a real art. I met her in the village, and she, you know, she was really devoted. I mean, this is where I got to go to make my career. and she was bureaucrat. So I called up and said, Al Ketzler's here. You know, I heard the secretary, you know,
right.
Oh, Mr. Ketzler, you know, and he hadn't met, you know, right. I thank God, because he sounded like he knew me. And he was saying, you know, God, we're so proud of you, what you've done for Alaska, you know, and whatever. And he said, well, how can I help you, Mr. Ketzler? I said, well, there's this young lady from Holy Cross that wants to go to the school. What's her name? I go, name? It's done. It's taken care of. I said, well, thank you very much, sir. And hung up. But she called me back a couple of days later and said, I got a ticket to Indian, you know, Indian art school.
Great.
So there's lots of stories like that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Smart. You see, you learn from Etok how to work this.
Yeah, well, that's.
Okay.